Hi everyone, this is Flo from the Great War Channel podcast here on a beautiful Monday morning in Berlin. And with me today, I have a special guest who is sitting in Denmark actually, and he's going to introduce himself now.
Hi, my name is Nicolai Ebalst. I'm an historian from Denmark, and my main field is the Austro-Hungarian Empire in the First World War. I've studied history at the University of Copenhagen, and I currently work at the Copenhagen City Archives. And then I'm also on Twitter as at PikeGrave1418, where I cover the First World War from the Austro-Hungarian perspective.
Welcome to the show, Nicolai. I will put a link to the Twitter account in the show notes, of course, because that was the work you're doing there is great, and that was basically how I actually got in touch with you. So
thank you.
Great work.
Thank you.
There. And I think, well, if, you know, our listeners probably just heard Austro-Hungary, then, you know, it must be just a Twitter account where you talk about the dysfunctionality of the Austro-Hungarian army. But it's not that quite that like.
No, not quite. It's a little more complicated than that.
As it's usually with history.
As it usually is. We tend to buy into some preconceived notions about how things are, how we are told it is, and how we've been told it was for almost 100 years. I think the Austro-Hungarian Empire in the First World War is a brilliant example of how our perception of the reality can be influenced and pushed to other people's views in a way that that we don't really see with maybe many of the other nations.
So do you think the basically the outcome, the dissolution of the Austro-Hungarian Empire has something to do with how the army is generally perceived?
I think it is. You don't really have a clear leveled and independent voice of the Austro-Hungarians until much later. Much of what you hear is from German sources at first, and you hear it from Western European sources, and you hear it from the general staff mainly, who have their own agenda they're trying to push. So that's what influences us a lot, and sadly, it has taken a long time for some of those notions to soften up a bit. Let's say it like that.
So let's start with a very broad question then. How would you rate the Austro-Hungarian army's performance in World War One? I know it's like a huge question, but maybe we can dive deeper into the details from there.
Yes, I think the Austro-Hungarian army is one of the lesser good armies of the war. They're not the worst, but they are certainly not the best. A lot of their trouble are the same trouble that a lot of other armies are fighting with in the beginning. They have the same ideas about all-out attack, like we see with the French. But I think that that bad leadership was the main reason for their troubles in the war. And they are perhaps the only army who loses the war, in a sense, in the first few months, as some historians have pointed out in recent years.
Ah, so basically after Galicia and everything, after the Battle of Galicia, there was no realistic way that they could have swinged around again?
No, not really the way I see it, because if you look at the numbers, the professional army of Austria-Hungary at the beginning of the war is between 400 and 500,000 people. And those are roughly the casualty figures in those first months of the war. So what they do is they lose almost their entire professional army within the first few months, and it's basically just playing catch up for the rest of the war. They don't have enough reservists, they don't have enough weapons, they have outdated weapons for a good part of the war. So for them to turn it around in an active war with soldiers on three fronts at least. Yeah, so of course some more fronts later on and small engagements, but three major fronts is yeah, it's hard to see how they would ever have turned that around.
Okay, and let's have a look at the Battle of Galicia, for example, and the opening battles and everything. What were some... Okay, I mean, we know on our show, we know Konrad von Hötzendorf. Yes. He has basically an online fan base now, thanks to us.
Yes, I've noticed that his name pops up more and more after you guys took an interest in him.
Let's maybe go a bit more into detail than just the strategic level. Maybe to have a look at more of the tactics and the individual army groups or even divisions and everything. How was the performance of the soldiers in the Battle of Galicia there? Do you have a few notable examples?
I would say that their conduct in battle was on par with every other military. They were dashing forward like we see with the French. They were brave, but as you guys are well aware, and that every army was made well aware of, that didn't necessarily work the way it had done in years before. You see famous regiments like the Imperial and Royal Infantry Regiment Number 4, and then of course they sometimes have titles, but those were gotten rid of later. But that was a famous regiment at the time, and even before the opening battles, they would lose their commanding officer because of an attack where they basically walked forward towards the Russians, and he was hit in the throat, if I believe correctly, and it cut his main artery in the neck. And it's the same story all over. They lose all of their officers, all their trained officers. They use most of their trained personnel, and what they're left with is the reserves, the Landsturm, as it was called. It was while the army performed well, they just lost too many men, basically. Numbers that they could never replenish.
And how did the makeup of the... I mean, the Austro-Hungarian army was, as was the Austro-Hungarian Empire, a multi-ethnic force, basically. Mm. I mean, you had as I remember, like multiple language versions of the national anthem, even, or the oath of allegiance was even conducted in multiple languages and everything. How did that affect the army in the early stages of the war?
In the early stages of the war, it probably affected it less than in the later stages of the war, because pre-war the army as a multinational, multi-ethnical, and multilingual institution, their officers were required to learn the languages of the men who served in the regiment. When you start to see problems when all those officers have died and you have to replace those officers, you get officers who have no time to learn a new language, who have no experience of leading these troops. And you see very weird situations where you have regiments commanded in English because it's the only common language they have.
Wow.
A lot of the soldiers who came in didn't know German, which was the official language of the army. The officers spoke perhaps mainly German and Hungarian, and there was just no time to learn each other's languages. So you had to make do, and you have to make do with translators. And in a battle situation, that's just not a recommendable trait to have in your army.
And that situation got even worse down the line.
Yes, as the war goes on, it gets worse and worse and worse, and you also get people in with racist traits who are racist towards the Slavs. You get the elements in who are perhaps less enthusiastic about the empire as a whole, nationalistic tendencies. It just goes down from there. So I would say that in the beginning of the war, to go back to your question, it is less of a problem because you have a trained army. The army is seen as one of the pillars of the empire, if you can say it like that. It's one of the few things, at least a common army is one of the few things that that the empire actually has in common. Otherwise, it's, as I'm sure you know, two states, Austria and Hungary. And it gets even more complicated because those two states also have their own armies. It's a complicated affair. But I think that in the beginning, not so much. Later on, it becomes one of the main issues.
But of course, the army, even though it was impossible to adapt at the pace required to come out of the war victorious again,
yes,
they still did adapt. I mean, in our show, we talked about the Jagdkommandos, for example. Mm. We talked about how they adapted to mountain warfare at the Isonzo Front and the Dolomite Front, where we visited and everything. Mm. So let's talk a bit about the notable examples where they managed to adapt to modern war, so to speak.
They did manage to adapt, as you can see. If you take like notable examples like 1914, it's very heavily infantry based. It's infantry attacks full on. Later on, in 1916, it's a much more focus on heavy fortifications, deep trenches, extensive trench fortifications, especially on the on the Eastern Front and the Italian Front, of course. They double the amount of machine guns. They get specialized weapons, or the likes of small infantry guns, to take out single positions from the frontline trenches, trench mortars, all those things. Of course, they, as you said, they have the Jagdkommando, but they also are heavily influenced by the German assault training and tactics. So they do adapt, but you can say that in many ways they take on a lot of wrong lessons as well. The Brusilov offensive is maybe one of the best examples of taking on the wrong lessons of war, where they have these strong fortifications, but they don't have any reserves. They simply do not have any ability to mend holes once the Russians break through the frontline trenches, and also they seriously lack the command structure, good officers. When the Russians break through, it's basically just every man for themselves. There's no coordinated retreats. Everything just breaks down, and it wouldn't have maybe on the German side, because they had better lessons, and that's why the Germans come in and almost take over command of the Austro-Hungarian army at that point.
Yeah, I mean, the Germans are, of course, big fans of the shackled to a corpse narrative in that sense. That,
yes.
You know, that's how they see their Austro-Hungarian ally. Mm. But on the other hand, I mean, if you look at the length of the Eastern Front in 1915-1916 and the amount of offensives they had, and, you know, as again, just the sheer length, was it even possible along the Austro-Hungarian sector to effectively man these kind of defensives with even having reserves and maybe fallback options and multiple layered defense and depth systems?
No, it probably wasn't. They didn't have the manpower to have a defense in depth. But what they really suffered was having a very strong front line, having most of the troops in the front line, having all your forces take the full brunt of the enemy attack, and nobody behind it. Where, as you see in maybe some parts of the Western Front and the German parts of the Eastern Front, you didn't stack up all your troops in the front line in the first trench, because you know that's where everything comes falling down the moment an enemy offensive starts. You need to have the reserves a little further back. You need to have them able to react to where things go wrong on the front. A lot of it stems from small successes on the Eastern Front, especially around the winter of 1915-1916, where these kind of tactics pay off for the Austro-Hungarian. The collectively known as the New Year's battles, where they stop Russian attacks. They sort of take on that, okay, this works, let's keep doing this. And then, of course, when the Russians have a more capable commander, as in Brusilov, then they realize very quickly that that was not the right thing to do.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, it's also the lesson that the Germans and then also basically the Entente learned, that you can't just put everyone in the front and then have them wait for the creeping barrage, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, let's look a bit more at the Alpine front, because that's one of the most interesting fronts of the whole war, I think.
Yeah, I think it is, and you can see it in the literature as well. While it's extremely hard to find work on the Eastern Front, maybe you don't notice it so much in English literature, but in German literature you see a lot more written about the Italian front or the Alpine front, especially the Alpine front, even perhaps more than the Isonzo front. The war above the clouds, or the white war, those romantic terms have really stuck with people.
Yeah, I mean, it's an incredible feat to look at it. I mean, first of all, that, you know, it was kind of also an industrialized war, because otherwise it wouldn't even have been possible to fight on these peaks. But also it illustrates both what man is capable of and that he can use these capabilities in a very senseless way.
Yes, indeed. The Italian front was a very different war from what you see on, say, the Eastern and the Western front. It's very unique, and I think what's more amazing about it is the fact that they did it in 1915, 1916, 1917. The lack of proper winter clothing, the difficulties of transporting supplies up and down a mountain, all those things just add up to a tremendous feat for these soldiers who fought there. And that's why this front do hold on to you. And if you've been to the places and seen the places where they fought, you really do realize how incredibly hard it must have been to fight in these conditions.
Yeah, absolutely. It was struck us very hard when we were on the Lagazui, which is something I recommend to everyone who is in the area to visit this part of Italy. But I mean, if we go back to your adaptation or lack of adaptation thesis on the Eastern Front, then the Alpine Front basically is kind of a success story in terms of adapting, because when Italy entered the war, the kind of losses you were talking about in the beginning already happened. And from what I remember, the Austro-Hungarians didn't have that many troops to even properly defend the Alps, the border with Italy. But they did.
They did. Of course, part of the credit goes to the Italians as well. The Italians had their own Conrad in a way, in the form of of Cadorna, and it was not known for learning the lessons. And you see this again and again with 11 attacks with very little variation. The fact that they wait so long before they make a proper effort allows the Austro-Hungarians to build defenses on this front, which really saves them, I think. I doubt they would have been able to hold a million men with the forces they have in May 1915. But they wait, and it gives the Austro-Hungarians a chance to build heavy defenses. And what you see is that it's constantly the Austro-Hungarians looking down at the Italians, and the Italians having to attack uphill in some of the most treacherous terrain in perhaps Europe.
Uphill is a very light term for what you see in the Dolomites.
In the Dolomites, but perhaps uphill is more applicable to the Isonzo front. The lower Isonzo, you see slopes where you can attack uphill, but you are in crossfire all the time. You see flanking fire from every direction, and they really make good use of the terrain. They have good officers who know the terrain, and they have perhaps more inspired soldiers than you see on the Eastern Front, who does not like to fight Slavs as much as they do love to fight Italians, in a way.
So there was a notable morale difference between the fronts.
I think there definitely was. You do see this the way in a way you also have it on the Italian front. It's a defensive war. On the Eastern front, it is of course defensive as well in periods, but it is also an offensive war. And if your army is not motivated, is not trained, I think that plays a huge part that you're fighting a defensive war instead of an offensive war, especially in World War One terms, where you see the casualty figures in an offensive war contra that of a defensive war.
Yeah. One story I read about, maybe you know more about this, is the story of the Bosniaken, the Bosnian regiment. They also, I think, they fought on multiple fronts basically throughout the war.
Yeah.
And as far as I read, they were the most decorated Austro-Hungarian regiment.
Yes. The second there were four at the beginning of the war, four infantry regiments, Bosnian and Herzegovinian regiments, and the second of them were the most decorated, the Zweite Bosniaken, and they did fight on several fronts, but they already distinguished themselves in Galicia in the opening battles, but I think a lot of their fame comes from the Italian front, because the enemy really feared these men, and they were brave, and they were generally good led, and they had good morale through the war, probably also as a result of being recognized as an elite.
Okay, so that's like the most decorated regiment of the war, of the Austro-Hungarian army. Do you know a few other notable regiments that did well in the circumstances?
I think a lot of the units fighting on the Isonzo front, especially, did remarkably well. Several hundred the Hungarian army regiments fought remarkably well around Mont Saint-Michel, and a lot of these units were sort of composite units of detached battalions from other regiments. So to say one regiment fought very well there is difficult, because it was often a battalion from one regiment put together with other battalions.
Was this because they always just needed to plug the holes that the Italians were creating with their offensives?
In a way, was but also because the Austro-Hungarian army before the war had a tendency of taking one battalion and having it transferred to the Balkans, so that you would have in the common army in the imperial and royal army you would have infantry regiments with four battalions, and they would often send one of these battalions to the mountainous regions, and they would be especially trained in mountain warfare. So some of these were battalions who had not been caught up in the battles in the east, where the rest of the regiments were fighting, and they sort of survived that way and became good units fighting together with other well-trained units trained in mountain warfare. A notable example is one of the Czech battalions from the 26th Regiment. And the 26th was one of the regiments which was disbanded in 1915 for allegedly defecting to the Russians in the Carpathian battles I believe they supposedly defected in April 1915 in the third battle. But their detached battalion, although this wasn't a detached battalion, it was actually a reserve battalion which had been sent to the Italian front. It served well and remained, despite the fact that the rest of the regiment had been dishonored, and earned recognition enough to have the regiment reinstated.
Oh.
Yeah. And it was even, if you go a step further, you can say that it was Borejovic, who to begin with had proposed it, or at least advocated for the disbanding, but he was also the one who recognized the regiment and pushed for its reinstatement in after its action in Italy, where of course he was in charge.
Okay, that basically, I mean, I have a bit of a knot in my head now. So if you want to research the Austro-Hungarian army, you will stumble across a situation where the same regiment fought on two different fronts at the same time.
Yes. Yes, you will. Way too often, I would say. It can be very annoying.
Do you know what? Okay, I mean, I can understand that they wanted to train some of the troops in mountain warfare and everything, but from an organizational standpoint, that strikes me as odd, because I would think that you want to keep the troops together for as much time as possible to form them into a cohesive fighting force, which is, for example, what the Canadians did on the Western Front.
Yes, it will strike as strange, but I think it a lot of it came as a tradition from the occupation of Bosnia. You sort of took away troops who would serve there from the remaining regiments. The Austro-Hungarians always struggle with not having enough troops, and this was perhaps a way, without having to build up new regiments, that they could take battalions from this, and they did serve as detached, almost independent battalions, together with other units, of course, in a more standard, more conventional hierarchy. So in brigades, in divisions, in corps, but the names of the battalions would correspond to another regiment.
Okay, interesting, very interesting. Okay, so before we wrap this up, of course, we need to talk a bit more about Konrad von Hötzendorf.
Yeah.
There are a few people who don't like our portrayal of him too much on the show. And one thing that I particularly read often is that his plans were brilliant, but the execution was poor. So he was actually quite a good strategist. In theory, was he?
I don't think so. A lot of his work pre-war was on tactics, not strategy. What you ended up with was the same man in charge of tactics and strategy. And I can see why some people might have a positive view of him in relation to how he was portrayed for a long time after the war as a sort of Austrian national hero. But I think that today most would agree that he was not very competent. A lot of people who hail him still would refer to some Russian sources saying that he was a good general. But again, you have to ask, how much did they know? Of course, they were on the receiving end, but how much did they know about the way that he worked the Austro-Hungarian army? I think the most illustrative, or what you could call it, example of his style was the Carpathian offensives, which were a complete disaster in every way, with no regards to the terrain, the weather, troop strength, troop morale, anything like that. Just numbers on a map. And you saw one regiment losing 1,800 men in a night from cold. But of course, they would still appear as a regiment on this map. But with those casualty rates, he would never have had a clear picture, and he wasn't a fan of visiting the front. There's not much good to say about him, I think.
Okay, so he was definitely not a good strategist.
I don't think so. I heard a lecture with one of the leading historians on the Austro-Hungarians, John Schindler, who said that one of his qualities was that he was not a Nazi. And that's perhaps what resulted in him being an acceptable hero figure after the Second World War. So if your one redeeming quality is not being a Nazi, it's not looking good.
Okay, well, I'm glad we talked a bit more about him as well. Thanks for your time, Nikolai.
You're welcome.
Again, if you guys out there want to learn more about the Austro-Hungarian army in 240 characters or less, I highly recommend following his Twitter project, PikeGrey1418 it is. It's well, we also retweeted from time to time, but you should really follow it to get the full experience. A lot of interesting pictures and everything. We of course should thank the Austrian archive here again to put out. They put out a lot of great quality pictures from their official records all the time. And do you want to say anything at the end about the Austro-Hungarian army that you always wanted to say?
Yes, I would love to say one last thing, and that is that people should really consider reading on past the 1914 mark when it comes to the Austro-Hungarians, because that's really where most of the one volume works on the war stops discussing them in detail. I think that's when they start getting more interesting.
Okay. Well, I will also see if I can put a few more sources in the description. Thanks for your time, Nikolai, and good luck with your Twitter project.
Thank you.